6:14 now on this Wednesday morning, August 6th. It seems to me, having grown up here, that I always associate August, traditionally, if it's a normal summer, with more rain and earlier in the day, and that seems to be what we're getting this year so far. Some showers already popping up in different areas, so be aware of that. Be careful if you're driving around. And remember, the state law says, and you might see the sign saying this, that if your headlights, if your wipers are on, your headlights have to be on. Okay, that's the state law. And the other thing is no flashers unless you're stopped. All right? 504-260-1870. That's Oakland Art Jeweler talking text line if there's anything you want to share with us. No texting and driving. We've been talking about healthcare costs, and we thought we'd talk to Patrick Penfield, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University, about tariffs and prescription drug prices and more. How you doing, Patrick?
Good, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. Let's talk about tariffs on US, on drugs, because we've been talking the last couple of days, as I said, about healthcare prices and how insurance is likely to go up. When it comes to prescription drugs, as I understand it from the people we've spoken to, we pay more here in the United States because the research is done here. I don't understand why we pay more. I thought I did, but I think the research is done here, but then other nations negotiate prices with drug companies. The United States doesn't. But what we're talking about here are drugs that are just manufactured somewhere else, correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, Tommy. I mean, we do manufacture drugs here in the States, but most of our drugs are imported.
And why is that?
Cheaper. So less costs, less regulations, less labor costs. So, you know, for the, you know, the pharmaceutical companies and the medical device companies, it's just less expensive, you know, to actually produce their goods overseas.
So let's talk about tariffs. What is the president proposing?
So the president's proposing an initial tariff. I think it's a small tariff, and then it's going to kick up to 150%, and then I think a year later up to 250%. So he really wants, you know, the medical device manufacturers and the pharmaceutical companies to start producing here in the United States.
So what would that look like, and how quickly could something like that happen logistically?
That'll take years. And that's just because, you know, you have to build a facility, you have to expand facilities, you have to order equipment, you have to, you know, get your supply chain in order. So it's not something that'll, you know, that can happen overnight. So I think the president is trying to kind of phase that in, you know, to get, you know, the pharma companies and the medical device companies to produce here in the States. And actually, Tommy, I'm a proponent of that. My preference is for, you know, these pharmaceutical companies and medical device companies to produce the United States more from a quality standpoint because, again, sometimes, you know, stuff that we bring in overseas is, you know, a little suspect as far as, you know, the quality of what we're receiving. And we've, you know, we've seen issues and problems before, eye drops and, you know, all these other situations that happen when you import drugs and there's no oversight.
And that goes to the inspection of the facilities, right? And who has the right to inspect them?
Yeah, so the FDA does, and it's
in
more difficult for them. Well, they can, but again, very difficult to do so.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's pretty lax, and I think that's what a lot of Americans don't know is, you know, a lot of that stuff that comes over is, you know, it's not tested. And so, again, you're at the kind of the mercy of, you know, whoever's bringing this stuff in. So the FDA does do inspections overseas, but not to the extent that they do here in the States.
And like you, Patrick, I'm all for it being manufactured here. However, from what I understand, about 10% of the healthcare costs in this country come from prescription drugs. And if you put a big tariff on that, the question is who's going to eat the tariff? Because unlike other products, I would think in this case, because the drug manufacturers, and I guess we've got to draw a line between generic and patented drug patented drugs are making big money, so maybe they could eat the tariffs. Take me through all of this.
Yeah, so what will happen is that prices will go up, you know, for pharmaceutical and medical devices. And so, and Tommy, your listeners may know this, may not, but so when a drug comes off patent, the drug companies automatically increase the price that last year. So the price, you know, dramatically goes up, which is kind of shocking. And then once it goes generic, that means that other companies can produce it because they, you know, the recipe is open and they can actually do that. Then usually the cost will drop dramatically. So, yeah, it's one of those things. It definitely, I think there is an issue there in regards to, you know, trying to control those costs. And Tommy, the big thing for the drug companies and the medical device companies is just the cost of actually producing new drugs. So it's really expensive, and so they try to recoup that cost with the high price of drugs. However, it seems like that we do pay more here in the States than other countries, which doesn't make sense to me.
So if we're talking about 100 to 250% tariff, who's going to wind up eating it? That's my concern.
Tommy, the consumer, yeah. So your listeners, ourselves, you and me, we will be paying more for those, you know, those particular goods. The only way that you can is if somehow you have some type of controlled pricing, you know, with drugs. And that's something that the Trump administration can do. They can do their investigation. I think they are, doing that right now. But there's no reason why the United States should be paying more for drugs than other countries. That doesn't make sense, and that's not right.
It would seem like if you are going to do tariffs, you would have to put some kind of price controls on the drugs like Canada does, or negotiate prices or something like that, because otherwise it seems like a double-edged thing. Either people aren't going to be able to afford the medicine, or companies are going to have to pay more in insurance benefits, which means that ultimately gets cost passed along to us. Or when it comes to Medicaid, the federal government will be paying tariffs into the U.S. Treasury, right, if they pay for drugs?
Yeah. Tommy, you're absolutely correct. Yeah, so there has to be some type of price controls enacted by the Trump administration, you know, once they start really ramping up and escalating these tariffs against these pharmaceutical companies.
I know we didn't invite you on to talk about that, but that was in the news. I thought I'd ask you about it. We'll talk about, generally speaking, tariffs taking shape. The president says that the import taxes will make America great and rich, making the country once again the most respected country anywhere in the world, ushering in a golden age. Do the numbers bear that out, or do we even know yet? 621 traffic now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Patrick Penfield, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University, about tariffs and the effect on the economy. We've already discussed prescription drug prices because that's in the news, and Patrick's given us a pretty good explanation of how all of that works and how tariffs would not be a bad thing, or at least how the drug should be manufactured here in this country. And I guess the question is, Patrick, how likely is that to happen?
It's going to take time, and so it'll probably be, could take as long as a decade. I mean, and that's, just, again, just trying to bring back stuff that we've outsourced and trying to get the supply chains all set up and build a factory. So, yeah, it's going to be a long, cumbersome process without a doubt.
So along those lines, what effect have tariffs had on the supply chain, if any?
Well, it's been brutal. So unfortunately, if you look at the tariff rates, and the next tariff is 8-7 tomorrow is when it's supposed to be enacted. You're looking at 10 to 41% tariff rates across the board, with all countries. So, the budget lab at Yale did this analysis, and they said overall the impact will be 18.3%, and that's the highest since 1934.
Wait, say that part again?
Yeah, so the overall impact of tariffs, 18.3%. That's how much the tariff rate is. So when President Trump came into office, it was 2 to 3%. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about a 15% tax, that's been enacted on anything that's been imported, that's being imported overall. So unfortunately, Tommy, that is not good from a cost standpoint. That means costs are going up, and they have been going up, and they'll go up even more in the second half of this year.
So again, $150 billion raised for the U.S. Treasury. The question is, where'd that money come from? Right.
Right. It's all those businesses that were importing materials. So I think the other thing, Tommy, your listeners may know this, may not, there's 6 million small businesses out there in the United States. And unfortunately, this is really difficult for them to absorb, this type of tax. And that's really impacting their margins. And not only with small businesses, we're starting to see this with large companies like Ford, GM, Stellantis, talking about billion-dollar losses.
So when it comes to the return of manufacturing to the country as far as the supply chain goes, have we seen any of that yet?
Limited. And so, again, this is one of those things, it's time. So probably the best analogy I can give you is, like, say, if you're a company and you built this puzzle and the puzzle's all set and you're happy and it looks beautiful, and then somebody comes over and just kicks it and just all the pieces are scattered. That's kind of what's going on with these companies. They're all trying to figure out, okay, we've got to redo our supply chains based off these tariffs. So So, you know, it's math and simple math, but it's time and it's not easy. So, you know, a lot of times the negotiations are done thinking it'll be very simple, but when you look at these supply chains that these companies have, they're very complicated. They're interwoven. You know, they're global supply chains. And so, you know, there's, you know, these issues that happen, you know, with their suppliers, with their supplier, the supplier. So it's just maddening, you know, how, you know, difficult this supply chain can be for some of these big companies.
I don't know if you remember the show The Office or not, but at one point Michael Scott comes in all excited. He wants to adopt a baby. And Pam says, well, it might take 6 months. And he says, well, I'm not sure I want a baby in 6 months. And while that's funny in a way, I think it goes to tariffs, and that is because companies need to plan 5-10 years out to make capital investment to return manufacturing here, but yet they don't know what the climate's going to be like in 5 or 10 years, right? So how do you do that? I don't understand if I'm running a company how I can do that, because the next guy or woman, whoever it is, may not be tariff-friendly at all. And then,
I'm
back to being undercut by another country, right?
Exactly. So it's causing paralysis with these companies because they can't plan. So there's no certainty. They don't know exactly what to do and how to do things. All right. So they're just, again, trying to operate within, you know, what's going on. And that's the other thing, too, is the president keeps changing things. Right. So, you know, if he says, hey, here's what it is, it's set in stone, then you can plan from that. But, you know, if you keep changing things from month to month to month with different countries, then it just causes chaos.
Is there any way the U.S., I know we got to go to news here, but is there any way the U.S. could put a tariff plan in effect that will be there 10 years from now so companies could plan, or is that up to each president to do that?
It's up to each president. Right. Yeah, so it's not, yeah, it's that, exactly. You know, right. So you've got each president can do whatever they want.
Thank you. Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate your time. Not criticizing President Trump, but I would just ask y'all, if you're a company, how do you figure out whether you're going to return manufacturing here? Because if you return it here and then the next person takes tariffs off, then you're being undercut in Vietnam and other places, and all of a sudden you got a factory that's empty. We'll take a break, come back, talk about redistricting right now. A minute late, time for WWL First News. For that, we'll go to Dave Cohen. 6:45, quarter till 7. We're into our regular, what I consider August pattern, where it rains earlier and more often, and that's what's underway this morning and will be underway today and for the next several days. Tropics, though, nothing to affect us, so we'll take it. Dane Ciolino joins us now, our friend, Professor of Law at Loyola. How you doing, Dane?
Just fine, Tommy. How are you?
I'm fine. Let's talk about redistricting and as it relates to Louisiana, because apparently, obviously, it's got everybody's attention with what's going on in Texas. Does what's going on in Texas have anything to do with the redistricting case as it relates to Louisiana?
No. What is going on there is a legislative fight over redistricting, and those happen routinely. What's happening in Louisiana is quite odd, and it has the attention of constitutional law scholars and court watchers all over the country, because this case, at least the most recent action by the U.S. Supreme Court, possibly portends a significant change of course by the court with regard to the Voting Rights Act. And that's what's so intriguing about this. As you may remember, the big argument as these cases were going up to the U.S. Supreme Court was whether or not the state violated the Voting Rights Act by using race as a predominant factor in creating that second minority district. And that was the principal issue that was looked at by most of these courts. What the Supreme Court has signaled is that it wants to look at the bigger issue, that is, whether any effort to intentionally use race as a basis for drawing congressional districts violates the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. And if they find that, it will essentially gut, if not jurisprudentially, overrule the Voting Rights Act that's been in place for more than 40 years.
So the Voting Rights Act was initially designed to give minorities more of a voice or more equal representation. So it would seem as though by design it had to take race into consideration, but now they're saying that that's wrong. I'm confused, Dane.
Yeah, well, as you know, a couple of years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court said that using race as a basis for public school admissions and is something that that violates the Equal Protection Clause, because the court has taken a essentially a colorblind approach to college admissions. And that decision is one that is playing out in other areas now, in just general employment and in government funding and those sorts of things. A lot of the, you know, DVE and DEI type programs that were government sponsored are in peril now. Well, this is just yet another variation on that theme with the court's most recent framing of the issue that it's going to take up in October, which is, can you intentionally use race at all in drawing these congressional districts? And I don't think anybody doubts that's exactly what Louisiana did, although certainly arguments were made that this was all about preserving Mike Johnson's seat and running Garrett Graves out of Washington. It clearly used race, and anybody who suggests otherwise is not being completely honest with
you. But I guess what I can't understand is, how would that be illegal if the Voting Rights Act was about race, using race, was it not?
Yeah, it was. And the court, in a case called Jingles that you've probably heard people talk about over the past couple of years, said that you could use race, but it couldn't be a predominant factor. Other things needed to matter, like how close together all the constituents were, what did the district look like, a snake snaking through the state rather than something more of a block with everyone hanging together geographically. But if this court does what it looks like it's going to do, if race is intentionally used as a factor at all, it's going to violate the Equal Protection Clause, which again, if that's the ruling that comes out of the court after the oral arguments in October, that is essentially a huge shift in policy.
Now, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We can back. Dane, as you well know, I have a keen legal mind, at least in my own mind. And I'm thinking that one of the arguments here would be that, well, if you're going to base it on race, you're presuming that all people of the same race are going to vote the same way, right? Because otherwise you're saying that why else would it matter? At least that, to me, would be the presumption. 651, 9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 657, 3 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola. If you'll notice, Dane, we turn your audio down as I proclaim myself to have one of the more brilliant legal minds in the country, because I didn't want any feedback about you from that. But anyway, let's talk about when it comes to if you're going to use race, and going back to the Voting Rights Act, I'll make a couple of statements. It would seem as though, A, if I'm arguing against it, I would say that you're presuming that all people of a certain race are going to vote the same way, because otherwise there's no argument when it comes to diluting their voting strength, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're right. That is one of the underlying assumptions there, is that in order to represent minority interests, you need to have minority public servants that their interests aren't represented by people of a different race as well as they would be by someone of the same race.
And I guess the other thing that would come up is the Voting Rights Act was 1964. I got that right?
Correct.
So have things changed since 1964 where protections like that are no longer necessary? Yes or no?
Well, certainly attitudes toward so-called affirmative action have changed politically, but more importantly for our discussion, the changes in the United States Supreme Court over the last 5 or 6 years with the Trump appointees giving the conservatives, so-called conservatives, a 6-3 majority. And that majority has shown very little tolerance for racial preferences in a number of contexts. And now in the context of districting and redistricting congressional districts, we're going to see in October whether the court is going to tolerate race-based policies under the Voting Rights Act.
You think they'll go like they did with Alabama or not?
No, I think given that we know they've got four justices who have voted in favor of reframing the issues to present this as a clear shot at the Voting Rights Act using the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. I think there's only they only need one more vote to do it. And my guess is they have it, and we're going to see this Louisiana district be declared unconstitutional in violation of the Equal Protection Clause.
Thank you, Dane. Appreciate your time and insight as always. Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, who always tolerates his fool gladly. We'll talk about bike safety when we come back. 7:14 into our August routine, what I think is normal August, with rain earlier and more often, showers over the causeway as I understand it right now. Next half hour, we'll talk to Jeff Nowak, WWL sports reporter, digital producer, Saints sideline reporter, about the black and gold as they head to California to practice and take part in the preseason game number one against the Chargers Sunday evening. We'll have all the action for you here on WWL. Aline, am I pronouncing it right? Laspina joins us now?
Yes, you got it?
Perfect. I'm sorry, yeah. Aline Laspina, who is the executive director of Bike Easy, to talk about bike safety and two cyclists killed on St. Claude Avenue weeks apart. Tell me what happened there, Aline, and we'll go from there.
Well, I mean, super unfortunate, you know, two more deaths on St. Claude, which is one of the state corridors running through our city, one of the most dangerous places, I feel like, for a lot of folks to bike right now. It's just very sad, you know, because it literally happened within 10 days of each other, mm-hmm. one at night, one, you know, during peak hour in the afternoon. It was very sad. We were very close to the second crash. We were actually presenting our Safer St. Claude campaign that night and, you know, kind of stumble upon these. So it's been very intense.
So tell me about St. Claude Avenue. What makes that so bad?
So there's a few things going on with St. Claude. You know, it's a truck route, so you have a lot of trucks going down there. There's a lot of issues with speeding, so people not, you know, the city is not necessarily enforcing consistently ticketing folks that are speeding. There's a lot of illegal parking on the neutral ground, which reduces the visibility for anybody that's walking around, that's driving or biking. So that just makes things pretty tough right there. Not all the lighting is working right now on St. Claude. There's not a lot of good crosswalk markings. Some of the signage is missing. So, you know, we've been just trying to get all the agencies involved in making this corridor safer come together and see eye to eye on a solution. And I think we're finally kind of there. So that's good.
And as you say that, somebody texted, and I know that bike wrecks on St. Claude is spurring the bike safety talk. We need police down St. Claude. It's like the Wild West out there. We don't need more infrastructure. Bike lanes are nice and wide. We need cops pulling people over without license plates that are speeding. It's even a little unnerving to drive a car down St. Claude Avenue sometimes. I haven't been there lately, so I wouldn't know this. In this instance,
yeah.
I'm reading the NOLA.com article, a Channel 4 article, rather, by Alyssa Curtis, a talented reporter. And she says, a cyclist was killed by an 18-wheeler, St. Claude and Frank Lawton Avenue. Authorities say the truck was headed west and the driver stopped, began to turn right onto Franklin. According to NOP, the cyclist reportedly entered the vehicle's blind spot and was pronounced dead at the scene, 65 years old. But to me, and maybe I have it wrong because I don't have a diagram or anything, but
yeah.
To me, Aline, this goes to the bike lane being between the right lane and the cross street, because that means a vehicle has to make a right turn and cross over the bike lane, and if it's in a blind spot, it's a recipe for disaster, right? Am I missing something? I always did think that was a bad design. Every morning when I come to work, I come down Camp Street, and right there at Poydras, they got a bike lane. I got to make a right turn, so I got to make sure that, A, nobody's coming down Poydras, right, because you got to drive defensively. Then I got to make sure that there's nobody in the bike lane in addition to pedestrians. Thoughts?
Yeah, correct. I mean, you know, and in this case, if the person riding the bicycle is going straight, it's really the person on the bicycle's right of way, you know, before the person that turns right. Back in 2019, there was a very similar incident on Elysian Fields and St. Claude Avenue. And I can't remember if it was the city or the state, but they actually changed the way that the design happens on Elysian Fields and St. Claude to make it safer. You know, so like that, you have more time if you're the truck to be able to see if somebody's coming in the bike lane. And I think that's the tricky thing. It's, you know, there has to be enforcement, there has to be changing design, but also changing behavior. We have to be aware that there's other users on the road. I mean, it's sucky. Like a blind spot for a truck is much bigger than a blind spot for a vehicle. But that's why, you know, you just have to be really cautious, especially if you know you're going next to a bike lane. Mm.
So when it comes to this case, do you know if anybody was charged in this or not?
I have no idea what I'm just how they're moving forward with these. Yeah.
So if you have a green arrow to turn right and there's a bike lane, the bike still has a right of way?
My understanding is yes. Mm. You know, the same way it says yield to pedestrians, you have to yield to people on bikes. I mean, and that's one of the things that needs to be improved in the corridor is signage for people to understand where they need to be. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes the designs are confusing.
I know people are texting in about bicyclists, and look, I see them doing the same thing, not using the lanes, not running through stoplights, and doing the wrong thing. But, you know, if you're going to call out bicyclists for that, you also got to call out the people in the cars that are seldom doing what they're supposed to be doing while they're driving.
Yeah. And you make a really great point. We like to remind people that we're people. It's people that we're talking about. It's not a vehicle that killed a person. It's, mm-hmm. you know, a person driving, a person biking. That's one of the things we're trying to just highlight. Like, these are people who are getting killed that shouldn't be killed.
I don't know.
This could be prevented.
Yeah, I don't know why there's this animosity toward bikers in the city, but there seems to be every now and then I get texts. I don't even know it's from people that live in the city. But you understand what I'm saying? Do you feel that sometimes?
Absolutely. And, you know, we've been around over 2 decades doing education on people who bike, whether they're kids or adults, seasoned people who bike, or just people who are pretty new to biking. And, you know, it's a constant struggle to just make sure that everybody's on the same page, the same way to make sure that everybody who drives is following, you know, like how many times we encounter people who don't use their blinkers, don't respect stop signs, run stoplights. You know, but again, we all need to shift the way we behave on the streets because we are not the only people on the road.
And the way we drive as well and paying attention to what the heck we're doing. And I got a new vehicle recently and it changed the way I drive because now I'm driving extremely defensively, which is the way I should have been driving all along. Aline Laspina is our guest, executive director of Bike Easy. We'll talk about bike safety more when we come back, about some bike lanes around some people. I'm getting texts here saying they're a waste of time put in places they aren't used. Other people saying, you know what, in the places where they're put in the right way, they're very safe. So we'll continue the conversation. You can text your thoughts in to me at 504-260-1870. That's the Oakland-Hart Jeweler Talk and Text Line. But I must add, no texting and driving. Pay attention to what you're doing. Back in a flash, traffic now, WWL. 7:26 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL. I'm getting some texts from you saying that my voice sounds low and everything's where it's supposed to be. I don't know what's going on with that, but I can't scream. I'm here for 4 hours. If I scream for 4 hours, I'm going to be hoarse when I go home, and I can't do that. Aline Laspina is our guest, executive director of Bike Easy. Aline, when you talk about right-of-way, my daddy always taught me, and this stuck with me, the right-of-way is not something you have. It's something people give you. If they don't give it, you don't have it. So what advice would you give to cyclists?
Be predictable. Signal, look around you. I feel for me, like when I ride my bike everywhere I go, that's my main means of transportation, is like make eye contact with a driver. Like the other day I was coming down just before Washington on Norman C. Francis, and it was my turn to go. I had clearly taken my lane to go straight, and this car just did a right hook right in front of me. Fortunately, I was paying attention, mm-hmm. so I did not collide with this vehicle. But
so
it
you
was
both had the green light.
Yeah,
you see, and
I was in the proper place on the lane.
That's what I'm saying. To me, that's and I don't know what they do in other cities. I don't know how you redesigned it, but that seems like a terrible design to me, because what you're telling me is, not you, but I'm saying the city,
is that you're
telling me we both have the green light and it's okay for me to cross over another lane of traffic. In essence, I'm making, as far as the bike lane is concerned, I'm making a right turn from the center lane over the right lane of traffic. That's what you're telling me to do.
You wouldn't do that with a vehicle.
No, that's the point I'm making. But the city's saying it's okay as long as you check first that there's no bicyclist in the lane, right?
Not going to speak for the city. I'll tell you what they do in other cities.
Well, tell me what they do in other cities then. Go ahead.
In other cities, usually there's a thing called the bike box, which we have a couple in the city. And it's technically, you know, where you usually have the crosswalk, or some people call it the zebra lines. Usually in that spot, there's a symbol so people know that the bicycle is going to get ahead of the traffic. So once the light turns, they're in front, so they know they go first. I think sometimes here it's a little bit confusing. Like if you're going down Barone and you're about to cross the interstate, you have to be like extremely careful because a lot of people are they're going to go into the ramp. So you have to like really look in the back and can make it clear I'm going straight so they know. And in my experience, more often than not, people are respectful of that. But, you know, there's bad apples everywhere.
See what you just said, that bike box.
Predictable.
And I think I've seen those in Algiers on De Gaulle. That makes every bit of sense, because what that is it's like a 90-degree turning lane or whatever. And the biker would have to be at the street level and pause so that there would be a buffer between the right lane, the bike lane, and the left, the center lane, or whatever you want to call it, that the vehicle is in, right?
Yeah, correct.
So it seemed to me like bike boxes are the answers.
Yes, and, you know, if we wanted to be that modern, there's some places that actually have lights specific for people who bike, which we have a lot of these, I forgot the exact technical name for it, but they're pedestrian lights around the CBD where, I don't know if folks have noticed, but the signal for the pedestrian kicks in to green before the light turns to green for a vehicle to allow the pedestrian to start crossing the street first, so they're more visible to a person that's driving. So,
thank you.
And if you notice next time you're driving down downtown, you'll see what I'm talking about.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. We'll talk to Jeff Nowak when we come back about the Saints here on WWL. You got any questions about the black and gold? 504-260-1870. Of course, we're going to have all the action for you here when the Saints take on the Chargers on Sunday evening. And Drew Brees is going to be a special guest on Sports Talk tomorrow. That's another note for you. We'll get Drew's take on Saints football, quarterback battle, head coach Kellen Moore, and the team's new strategy, plus NOLA Pickle Fest, Drew's annual pickleball tournament community event, which is happening tomorrow through Sunday in the heart of New Orleans at the Convention Center. It's a great event that blends fast-paced competition, live entertainment, and family fun, all in support of the Brees Dream Foundation. Saints legendary quarterback, Super Bowl champion Drew Brees, tomorrow afternoon at 5:30 here on Saints Radio, WWL. We'll talk to Jeff Nowak when we come back right now, WWL First News. Man, I can't wait till Sunday. I'm going to tell you what. Saints getting it going preseason with the battle at the Chargers. Game day coverage starts at 11 o'clock Sunday morning. Steve Geller, Charlie Long for First Take. Then at 1, countdown to kickoff with Bobby Hebert. Get all-pro analysis of the matchup. Game time, 3:05. Turn down your TV, turn up the home team. Deuce, Mike Haas, and Jeff Nowak on the sideline. And after the game, join the Cajun Cannon for the point after. 10 hours, wall-to-wall Saints coverage. Saints at Chargers Sunday on Saints Radio, WWL, and the free Odyssey app. The aforementioned sideline reporter Jeff Nowak joins us now. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. I'm all packed. I'm ready to get on the plane. You know, excited for the significant drop in humidity I'm about to experience. You know, it's good stuff.
People that have never been on a team charter flight have no idea the freedom that you enjoy, do they?
Well, the preseason, we fly commercials.
Oh, so
we're
you?
We're like the rest of you.
Oh.
Yes, yes.
Well, in that case, you got to go through security. You got to fasten your seat belts and so forth. Normally on those charters, they don't even tell you when they're taking off. It's like what do you call them? It's like, you know what it's like? It's like the Ten Commandments movie when Moses goes up to get the mountains. They got people running around doing all kinds. No, I'm just teasing. Tell me about your impression so far. What has stood out most to you at Saints training camp?
Yeah, well, what stood out is I think maybe the offense is a little behind the defense at this point, and so we'll get a better picture of that on Sunday. Because early in camp, it's always like, all right, the defense is winning, but how good is the defense? Right? Mm-hmm. That's always the question when you're playing. You know, you don't play against your own defense in games; you play against other teams' defenses. So, I think this weekend is where we kind of start to get a picture of, okay, is maybe the offense a little ahead of the defense because are the defense a little ahead of the offense because the defense is in line for a really big year, which is what you'd hope. Or is maybe the offense just scuffling a bit, and that's not completely unreasonable considering you change schemes. You have two young quarterbacks, they're competing, so they're, you know, you're not getting, you know, if you had picked one guy and you said this is the starter, he'd be getting all the first team reps. Instead, mm-hmm. you're kind of splitting those, so you're not getting as many reps. So maybe both guys are a little further behind the curve than they would be if they got all the reps. And that's kind of where I'd like to see, personally, this quarterback competition wrap up on the earlier side, because I do think that you need to get one of these guys, whoever it is, I don't really care who it is, you need to get one of them enough reps so that week one rolls around, because it's going to be here before you know it, and I want them to be ready. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
I think that's very interesting, because I would then ask you, if one distinguishes themselves, although not everybody can play with the ones, right? I mean, how do you let each quarterback play with the ones and really show you what they can do, or against the ones, in with only three preseason games, and yet still determine who it is that's standing out to give them the most reps? It seems like a conundrum to me.
That's the tough part of a quarterback battle, right? It's not as difficult with any other position, because you can kind of alternate and you can switch them out. With a quarterback battle, it's also contingent on who are you playing with, right? You don't really want to have the first team offensive line in there the entire time. And you also, you can't really call it first team reps unless the quarterback's out there with the first team offensive line, right? There was the Jets had a problem a while ago with Rex Ryan as a head coach, because they had Mark Sanchez in there who was supposed to be their starter, but they pulled their starting offensive line. He ended up getting hurt because he was playing behind the second stringers. And so you don't want that to happen. But you also have to kind of balance it out if you're really dedicated to the quarterback competition part of it. It's a lot easier to do in practice than it is to do in a game, right? Because you're not hitting in practice. And so you have a little bit more safety built in with your offensive line. Like yesterday, for example, at practice, Spencer Rattler got the first team reps for the first several sets of drills. And then the final set of drills, which is third down specific, Shuck was in there with the first team offensive line and first team receivers for the final nine reps, right? So you kind of balance it out that way. It's going to be interesting to see how they do it in a game, right? Do you alternate series? Do you alternate quarters? Is your plan to have this ride through the second preseason game, which would allow you to say, hey, we're going to get one of these guys the first team reps in this game. Next game, we're going to get that other guy the first team reps, and you go from there. The issue is, like I mentioned, you know, I think you'd really like to home in on one of these guys, and that's really just slowing it down. But it's going to be up to Kellen. Like, this is his first time as a head coach. It's his boat, so he gets to steer, and we'll see how he manages it.
Let me take a quick break. We come back, I want to talk about the practice on Sunday, and I guess as it relates to other training camps, was it brutal or not? Was it productive or not? And also, when it comes to the defense, some players that have particularly stood out to you. We're talking to Jeff Nowak, Saints sideline reporter. Saints tee it up against the Chargers on Sunday afternoon, kickoff 3:05. Our coverage starts at 10 here on WWL. Right now we pause for traffic. 7:58, our coverage starts at 11 on Sunday with the Saints taking on the Chargers. Jeff Nowak, Saints sideline reporter. Tell me some names on defense. I know I hear Chase Young's having a pretty good camp. Who else?
Yeah, Chase Young is kind of flying around. You know, he dropped a little weight. Him and Carl Granderson, I think they're playing a little lighter this year. So, you know, they just seem a little more mobile than we've had in years past, and hopefully that helps. You know, one of the issues the Saints have had is dealing with mobile quarterbacks. I think this new scheme is going to help that. You know, Devon Godshaw is a guy that I think, you know, when the Saints switched defenses, their biggest need was, hey, we got to go get a nose tackle who can help us stuff the run. And I think he was exactly what they needed. They traded for him from the Patriots. He's just, you know, we talked to offensive linemen, his fellow defensive linemen. This is a league full of big, strong guys, and they're all raving about how big and strong he is. So, you know, he's just going to be a load in there. I think he's going to help a ton because this team just hasn't done much against the run the last couple of years. You know, a depth guy who's been interesting is Jasheen Davis. He's a UDFA out of Wake Forest. Over the course of last week, I think between three practices, he had five sacks with the second and third team. So he's kind of been all over the place. So I'm hoping he can keep that going in the preseason game on Sunday. And then Kool-Aid McKinstry has just been kind of blossoming into a star this camp. You needed that because you moved on from Paulson to Debo, Marshawn Lattimore. So you're kind of resetting at the cornerback position. You need, and I think every good defense has, you know, one of those guys you just don't want to throw at. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think he's kind of developing into that. He's confident. He dropped a little weight as well. He's playing more closer to his Alabama weight when he had a lot of success as a sophomore. So he's feeling really good about himself right now.
Thank you, Jeff. Have a good trip. We'll talk to you again soon. Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. Of course, we'll be listening for him and Deuce and Mike Haas doing a game on Sunday afternoon, because it is a lot more enjoyable when you listen to it on WWL, turn on TV sound, especially during preseason. My Lord in heaven. Hot and humid, as you would expect for August 6th, and also, it seems like traditionally in August, and let me ask Ronald Serpas here, professor, practice Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief, New Orleans native. Do you remember August as seeming more rainy and it rains earlier than normal?
Yes, it always seemed that way to me. I mean, you know, if you have family that live in Central Florida, they have it every day, like 3 or 4 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
But I think here we're seeing them a little later in the evening, 6, 7 o'clock last night, and forecasted again for today at 6 or 7.
Yeah, it seemed like sometimes in August they come earlier, though, for whatever reason. Maybe not. I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you what, it interrupts your evening stroll, Tommy.
Mm, if you take one.
That's it.
Yeah, I got a dog, Grady, G-R-R-R-A-D-Y, grr. That's how I named it that way. And it's amazing when I tell a vet the dog's name, they get irritated at first that I have to have 3 R's in there until they realize when I'm dead, and then they laugh. So I guess it works out. But this dog loves to go out in a pouring thunderstorm and play ball. Rather than being gun-shy, when a thunder starts to roar or roll or whatever it does and lightning strike, he picks up his ball and he wants to run outside. But that's got nothing to do with crime. Let's talk about the FBI report that's out.
Sure.
You are an analyst. Tell me what you found when you went through this.
I found nothing surprising. I mean, remember this. The FBI crime reports are voluntary submissions by police departments. So it's not all police departments. It's been like that forever.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, there's a companion report done by another part of the government that polls people across the country. When you compare those two reports together, you find out that about a half of all crime in America every year goes unreported to the police. 70 to 75% of Americans understand crime from what their friends, family, and neighbors tell them about crime. Definitely not what the government tells them about crime.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom line becomes this. We in government and media count crime. People feel public safety. Those are night and day differences. So I always took them with a grain of salt. Yes, we talked about them. Yes, we celebrated if we thought they were going down in our particular city. But they're just a gauge. They're not really that informative when you think about all these other known facts and the way people perceive crime and in the amount of crime that goes unreported. What was also released this week, that doesn't get a lot of attention by the media, and that's just the way it is. But it was also released this week, the National Crime Victimization Survey, which I spoke to, which shows tremendous percentages of crimes are not reported to the police at all. Final point. And what we suffer with here in New Orleans, when you have a tremendously long wait time for property crimes, that's going to drive down the property crime reports known to the police. The reports known to the police is what the FBI uses. So when the FBI says there's an 8.1% decrease in property crimes in the cities who've contributed, many of those cities like New Orleans have experienced tremendous increased wait times since COVID. And there's definitely a factor of having a halo effect of reduced property crimes when, in fact, they might not have been reduced much at all.
You know, I remember talking to you about this and I was about perception, and I was thinking about this yesterday in anticipation of you coming on today, and that is, and I want to open the Open Our Jeweler Talking text line here at 504-260-1870 on what amount of basis or how often do you think about crime every day? Because I guess I live a sheltered life. I live in Belchase. Property crime, for the most part, I think is non-existent, at least as far as I'm concerned. Violent crime, non-existent. I've never been a victim of a violent crime or go to places where, you know, it's for whatever reason high risk or anything like that. So I got to tell you, when it comes to crime, as far as perception goes, that would be, I don't even know how far down the rank on my list, if it even shows up on my radar at all. Is that what you're talking about, kind of like, or it all depends on where you live or how it affects you?
I think that's absolutely the case, because if you live in a suburb or a rural area, you don't hear crime daily in the news. You don't hear crime daily talked about among friends and family. There is crime, but it's definitely less. I mean, that you just can't get around that. What happens in America, and this is my personal opinion, when we hear about police practices or crime, it tends to be populated in the media centers of America, not media as an industry, but just where the big major markets are, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Detroit, New Orleans, Miami. And people who watch the news and get these national narratives about crime more often than not look around and say, well, that's not the way it is here.
Mm-hmm.
right? And that's what we see with the rates of police misconduct and accusations of police misconduct. What the national narrative tells us is not the same as what says in our neighborhood. So that's why that point, Pew Research does this all the time. About 70% of Americans perceive crime based upon what their friends, families, and neighbors told them. They trust local media and the police a little bit, and believe it or not, and this is an attack against our friends in the elected group, they don't trust politicians at all. This is Pew Research, right? Because you know why it is. People feel that there may be some jaded use of the crime data, left or right, doesn't matter. But that's it, Tommy. People feel crime. Governments report crime, and those are different, like night and day.
I'm glad you said that. Let me rephrase the question for people to text in. On a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being not at all, with 10 being pervasive, how do you view crime in your everyday life, or how often do you think about a scale of 1 to 10? I would be a 1 to 0, because I seldom even think about it other than when it's on the news. And it seems like primarily what's going on in New Orleans has been domestic as of late. We'll talk about that when we come back, and more with former NOPD Superintendent Ronald Surpass, head of the Nashville City Police and Washington State Police, now a professor at Loyola and a consultant to all kinds of different people. 820 Traffic, WWL. 826, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Ronald Surpass. Did you ever understand why the term flatfoot was derogatory for a police officer?
I don't know. Suspected that they thought they were walking beats all the time before cars. Probably right? Somebody on your feet all day.
Yeah, somebody made up in a movie once and everybody started repeating it. Let's talk about a number of police officers that were killed, because that number has gone up. Does that tell you anything? Can you infer anything from that?
I'm not sure that 1 year's change of four horrible deaths tells us a lot yet. We know there's usually around 100 or so police officers killed in the line of duty. Generally, about half the time it's accidents. The other half of the time it's felonious behavior. So this is something worth watching. Young men and women who do this work are killed. Tommy, let's just go back to this other thing for a second. The brand new report that just came out last week. New Orleans would be considered urban and suburban, right? 38% of violent victimizations are reported in urban communities, 43% in suburban. That's violent crime. Property crime, about 25% of property crime in urban areas and about 33% in suburban areas is reported. Reported crimes become the UCR crime. So you can see the gap here. Tremendous amount of number of crimes just do not go reported. The loss of a police officer in service sometimes is considered an attack on society at large, because they are the most visible. They are the most visible reference of society's contract with one another to perform our lives in ways that meet moral and legalistic standards. So when police officers are killed, many people will say this is an attack on society. Many states have a death penalty for that work because of it. So it's always bad. Two police officers died in service during my time as chief, and both of them were killed in accidents. They weren't killed feloniously.
The way I look at it is that if somebody is going to intentionally murder a police officer, they would kill me or my child without it thinking twice. Is that what this is?
I think that's accurate, and I think that's what people think, and that's one of the reasons this guy Groves, who's still missing from the Orleans Parish escape, 12 weeks ago, is that he had been convicted of murder, multiple counts of murder. He has nothing to lose. The chances of him hurting someone to protect himself from police is very high.
Let me ask you this about cameras, because I was trying to think about a reason as to why it might be up or down crime. Is there any way to determine the efficacy of cameras when it comes? Because you can't, I'll watch movies now and I'll say, well, you can't do that because that would be on a camera. You can't do that. That would be on a camera. Has that, between Ring doorbell cameras, between security cameras all over the place, has that helped decrease crime, you think?
Let's separate it into two things. A camera in a public place, the research would generally tell us that it does not reduce violent crime, but it could reduce some property and annoyance crimes. That's separate from cameras on people's homes and businesses. I think the difference is not only what I just said, but home cameras and business cameras are at eyesight level. They're not a public camera in the air. So I think we have better chances of solving crimes with identification of somebody's face from a house or a business camera, because that's usually at street level or door level, whereas a public camera is up in the air. So the two work in concert. But again, to recap, the research on public cameras pointing down on street corners, very little effect on violent crime, some effect on property and nuisance crimes. But that camera on your doorbell or that camera in a business is most likely to catch somebody's face.
And is that
a picture that you can use as a lead?
When it comes to the overhead camera, is that because of hot blood, passion, or beefs, whatever? It's like, I don't care if you see me or not, I'm taking this person out?
It has something to do with that. And remember this, violent crime is most often a crime between people who know each other and they're angry and something goes wrong and someone gets hurt. That's actually been the case for decades.
That's what I was trying to say. Thank you, Chief. Appreciate the expertise. As always, we'll talk to J.P. Morrell when we come back about this whole French Quarter thing. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. All right, 844, 16 till 9. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by J.P. Morrell, New Orleans City Council Member at Large. How you doing, J.P.?
I'm good, Tommy. How are you this morning?
I'm all right. So tell me where we stand with this French Quarter thing, because I was under the impression there was two companies cleaning it, but it's only one now, correct?
Yes. So the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the residents against the mayor regarding her emergency contract. So that emergency contract disappeared, and the mayor did the right thing and reinstituted the IV waste emergency contract through December of this year. So there's one person picking up trash, one company doing the trash, while the lawsuit that Mr. Henry has against the city council still goes through the court process. And the last hearing on that case was the 5th, so yesterday.
And I hate to go over the same stuff over and over, but people have a hard time following this. Mr. Henry's beef with the city council is?
He had a contract that the mayor signed. The council also has to sign contracts to make them valid contracts for sanitation. There were a lot of discrepancies with the Henry contract, including him being prepaid for trash pickup, which no trash company's ever been prepaid for trash pickup, him only being required to carry half a bond versus a full bond. And because of those highly irregular clauses, the council refused to sign the contract, which under the law means he has no contract. Rather than accept that, he went to a court and demanded that the court make the council sign the contract. The district court ruled in his favor, so we are at the appellate court because the council does not believe, and that's basic civics, that a court can make a legislative body vote and make the legislative body vote the way the court wants.
What does the city charter say about, for specifically, the contract with Henry Consulting?
The city charter doesn't say anything specifically about
a contract like that. I phrased the question poorly, but
the city charter is very gray when it comes to contracting, which is why when the charter is gray, much like the Constitution, you are able to determine what you want to happen in law. The law says, and this was after the original Jimmy Woods, Alvin Richard post-IDA process, the first part of our term. A law was passed requiring that we have transparent public conversations about trash contracts and that the council and mayor would have to jointly approve them. That law was passed in late 2022, early 2023. It was not vetoed by the mayor, and that law remained on the books for several years until Mr. Henry made this lawsuit. This was another instance in which you have people challenging laws the mayor doesn't like, and so she made the city attorney not defend the law, which required us to once again hire outside counsel to defend laws that are on the books that the mayor doesn't like.
If for whatever reason Mr. Henry wins his legal action, is he going to get some kind of back payment for this or not? Or do you know?
No.
No.
That's not the way it works. So first off, if he wins at the appellate court, it goes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, as you've seen from the citizen contract, is more than willing to weigh on these issues because they are balance of power, legislative, executive issues. The challenge is that the timing of these contracts and the timing of these appeals, even if we were to lose at the appellate level, it is more than likely that either party is going to go to the Supreme Court, and this case could well drag into the next mayor's administration. You're not entitled to back pay for work that wasn't done. And since the emergency contract is in place and Mr. Torres is picking up trash, the city is not required to pay back pay to someone for work that wasn't completed. Further, there is a clause inside of Mr. Henry's contract in dispute, which allows for termination for lack of appropriation. And when the dispute began, the council filed an ordinance to terminate the contract under its own clauses by defunding the contract. So there is a high likelihood that even if Mr. Henry were to win his case, the council would still move to terminate the contract under the language in the contract.
You know, for the average person, this sounds like a lot of legal gobbledygook and a lot of politics and this, that, and the other thing. Do you have any idea how much is going to wind up costing the taxpayers of the city this whole exercise?
Right now, the only thing that's costing the taxpayers is the council's lawyer from when Mr. Henry sued. So, and honestly, it would have cost the taxpayers nothing had the mayor allowed the city attorney to defend the council in the suit, which is the city attorney's job. So right now, other than having an emergency contract in place, which considering the work that's being performed in the quarter and the fact that for the first time probably in the history of the universe, residents and businesses in the quarter agree on something, I don't think people in the quarter feel like for the service they're getting that that money is ill spent. But as I said, the only money that's being spent right now is the council defending itself because Mr. Henry sued the council.
Let me take a break.
A couple hundred thousand dollars.
And I want to go back to the nature of this emergency because I'm getting a lot of text on this. People still don't understand how we got to an emergency situation. We'll go back and look at that with J.P. Morrell. New Orleans City Council Member, 850, 10 till 7, 10 till 10, hello, 10 till 9, traffic, WWL. All right, 8:56, 4 minutes left with J.P. Morrell, New Orleans City Council Member at Large. J.P., just for a little bit for people that are asking, take us back to how we got to this, quote, emergency situation with trash collection in a quarter. J.P., you there? You got me muted? You got me muted maybe, J.P.?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm back.
That's right. Tell me real quick how we got to this, quote, so-called emergency, because I got another question to follow up with after you tell me that.
Well, the only actual emergency is that when the Henry contract was declined by the council, the mayor refused to rebid it. So the mayor and council jointly agreed to hire Ivy Waste because of the Super Bowl, and they were in place to get the lawsuit resolved. The mayor manufactured a fake emergency to try and give Troy Henry the contract, and that's what the court just threw out. So we're still with Sydney.
So I see a story here posted at NOLA.com. Orleans Parish Clerk of Criminal Court is looking in a landfill for records that City Hall threw out. How hopeful are you that, and I don't know if you're going to endorse anybody for mayor or not, but how hopeful are you that the next mayor will work with the council and all of the foolishness and the shenanigans will stop?
I don't know. I mean, I'm hopeful that there are people who are running that will work with the council and turn the page on this mayor. But there are a lot of people that are running for mayor that don't think the current mayor is doing a bad job. Mm-hmm. And I would certainly tell every voter out there, pay attention to what these candidates are saying or not saying. If they aren't willing to say, I'm going to turn the page from Mayor Cantrell, that should be something that's disqualifying from my perspective. We need a clean break from this mayor.
Do you plan on endorsing anybody for mayor?
Not this time. Right now, I'm in my own race.
I have my own
reelection that I'm doing, and potentially after the primary, certainly I'll take a strong look at the candidates and see who's still there, and I'll endorse the person that I think is going to be the most different from the current mayor that we have now.
Yeah, we didn't invite you on about this, but Clerk Darren Lombard saying city workers told by Public Works Director to move official court documents, including murder and rape cases dating back to the 50s, and they just put them in a Gentilly landfill, and now they're going through the landfill to try to find them. Generally speaking, this is, in microcosm, how city government is not functioning currently. Would that be an accurate statement?
I think so. I mean, the reality is that I don't know in what universe that people thought it was appropriate to take trailers from the clerk's office to see documentation in it, and for some reason think that it was appropriate to dump that documentation in a landfill. The reality is that even if it did need to be disposed of, Tommy, that all that information has personal information, has sensitive information. If it was going to be destroyed, as a clerk would do if it was eligible to be destroyed, it needed to be shredded and disposed of properly. So it was literally just it was one hand not talking to the other, one hand ignoring what was supposed to happen. And it is, you're right, kind of a personification of kind of the the inability of the administration to communicate with other elected officials or to work with other elected officials.
I hope we turn the page. Thank you, J.P. Morrell. Appreciate it. We come back, we're going to talk about President Trump and an executive order as it relates to name, image, likeness. We'll be back, WWL. I got motivation for you, and here's the motivation. I would have nothing to say about President Trump because I wouldn't want to spend the rest of my life in jail, which, granted, would be about 90 minutes. Not well, yeah, yes. Well, that goes. It's an Epstein joke, but you Google all of that and get back to me. Thank you. All right. You know, when you're explaining, you're behind the curve, but that's okay. Thank you, Dave. Matt Brown joins us now, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. Talk about President Trump. As a matter of fact, signing an executive order or an NIL in college sports, will it have an impact? Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Point newsletter, our friend. How you doing, Matt?
Hey, I'm doing great. Happy to talk about executive orders. Happy to talk about the president. Hopefully, you don't ask me any questions about Epstein.
I am absolutely not going to do that. It was just a little joke about, 90 minutes in the rest of your life in jail being 90 minutes. Now,
Sure. You start asking those questions. I'm on the air. I'm on an SEC regulated channel. Next thing you know, my newsletter disappears.
Next thing you know, you're being audited.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. I don't file. I don't pay taxes. Oh, have I got a mess waiting for me? Let's talk about what the executive order says. I don't know the best way. Matt, we're going to spend an hour with you because this is extremely complicated. It goes back to the House agreement. There's a lot of material to present. You're the expert. You tell me. But first, tell me about the Extra Point newsletter.
Sure. Extra Points is a publication. It's a newsletter that comes out 4 days a week that covers business, policy, and off-the-field stories that shape the college sports industry. Whether you're an SEC big-time program like LSU, somebody in the Southland or A-Sun, or down to the Division II, III, or NAIA levels. It's read by students, graduate students, and folks that work in the college sports industry all over the country.
So you can stay informed. How do you get it? You just go and subscribe, or is there a free issue?
That's right. You just go to extrapointsmb.com. There is a free edition and a premium edition, and it gets sent to your inbox about 4:30 Central Time every morning.
And you might want to subscribe because this is complicated stuff that you have to read and reread and reread, because let's talk about the executive order, and I guess we'll work back from that. When did President Trump issue the executive order, and what did it say?
Sure. So this would have been, the internet's kind of ruined my sense of time here at this point, but it was, I think, about 2 weeks ago. It's one of the challenging things about trying to cover the federal government is that the rules that we might have learned about how policy is made back in college or in high school and what's the purview of Congress versus the executive branch, that seems to have changed a little bit here. This administration is pretty aggressive about wanting to shape policy through the executive. What the EO is stating essentially is that the White House wants college sports to continue to preserve Olympic sport opportunities, to ensure that college athletes are not deemed as employees, and that NIL opportunities or outside competition opportunities are not, quote, pay for play, which is a lot of what the House settlement was attempting to kind of codify here. The challenge is that the NCAA and the CSC's ability to really enforce a lot of these rules run afoul of federal antitrust laws. And the White House can't unilaterally create an antitrust exemption. So the interesting question that folks in Washington and folks watching Washington are trying to figure out here is this EO more about trying to push lawmakers to do the thing that Trump wants? Or can Trump use the Department of Education or the DOJ or the federal grant apparatus to lean on schools in other ways to make them do what he wants?
First of all, as it relates to executive orders, the president is not doing anything that has not been ceded to him, whether you agree with it or not. I'm not talking about you, Matt. I'm talking about the listening audience. Congress has, in a lot of ways, abdicated their duties because they want to get reelected. They don't want to take on the tough stuff. So they've said, you know what? Okay, let the president do it, not just President Trump, but with executive orders. So along those lines, when I heard this, the first thing I thought of is, oh, Lord, here we go back to court. Who's the boss of who? And what happens this season? Because the House settlement's been in effect for about a month or so. I don't somebody texted in, Jordan asked me, have there been any winners beyond billable hours as it relates to the attorneys? And I think that might be a good question.
It is a good question. I think now is a pretty good time to be in business if you are an agent representing elite athletes. Even with some confusion about what parts of the House settlement are actually going to be enforced or not, because schools can and have been for the last, 6 weeks or so, directly paying athletes, in many cases, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, now is a good time to be in the business where you're taking somewhere between 8 and 15% of that as an agent commission, whether that's through the transfer portal, whether that's re-upping a contract with the school that you're already with. I think this has been positive for the college sports industrial complex. If you are in the business of selling compliance software or consulting services or salary cap data, the business is booming. But for everybody else, yeah, there's a lot of confusion, just like I think it would be if you were, locally here working in the oil and gas industry or in real estate development, and the rules change every 4 weeks. Makes it difficult to build the infrastructure you need to figure out how you actually run your business.
So what I'm trying to figure out here is if we put maybe one side and the other, didn't they used to have matching things in school, matching tests where you would go from one side to the other, you'd match one with C or two with X or whatever the correct answer was. Remember that deal? Didn't they have some guy, you drew lines or something like that?
I vaguely remember doing this as a teacher, yeah.
I think that was on the medical exam. I'm not quite sure. No, anyway. So let's put the House settlement on one line and on one side of the page and the Trump executive order on the other side and start drawing lines with what matches with what or what doesn't match with what, if we can do that.
Yeah, well, I'll try to do that. Okay. So the House settlement says that athlete compensation, if it's not coming from the school, needs to be tied to some level of fair market value.
From the school.
Exactly. If it's not the school, so long as it doesn't go over the salary cap, can pay an athlete however much they want. And then if the athlete's going to get money from somebody else, whether that's Domino's Pizza.
Now we're talking about name, image, and likeness here, right?
Yep. You and I. Okay. If that money is supposed to be tied to fair market value.
Meaning you can't.
Meaning that,
go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say you can't have Tommy Tucker's hairstylist. I have no hair. The reason I said that. Paying somebody because I'm rich and I want depth on the offensive line, paying each backup offensive lineman for LSU $1 million a year to endorse my hair salon, right?
That would be exactly right. What would happen is that what should happen based on the way the settlement is drawn out is that if you sign a backup LSU offensive lineman for your Miracle Hair Tonic, that goes into a big
even
database.
Better Miracle Hair Tonic.
Okay. Miracle Hair Tonic. Yeah. Yeah, we'll pull something right out of the 1870s here, right? Yeah. Some snake oil.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that gets run through a big database run by Deloitte to compare how much you're offering to pay versus a general pay range of what other people with similar social media followers and at similar programs performing similar services, what they might make. And if they say, whoa, 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 you're paying 70% more than everybody else is paying to do a brand deal, then you need to renegotiate this.
But at the risk of hurting myself, it sounds like you're talking about an index. And if that's the case, then it would seem as though everybody could drive it up to where the fair market value could indeed be $1 million a year for an backup offensive lineman if, for whatever reason, Tommy's Miracle Hair Tonic chose to spend his money that way. If the people, Bubba's Hair Tonic in Alabama chose to do that, or Texas Hair Tonic in Texas chose to do that, if it's an index, then everybody could drive it up, right?
You could. If you could find enough hair tonics throughout the country to work with 310-pound right guards, you could.
Or and supporters with deep enough pockets.
That may be what happens.
Supporters with deep enough pockets, right?
Exactly.
Because the product doesn't matter.
We're 6 weeks into the system. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, right. I think what's important to reiterate here, though, mm-hmm. is that's what the settlement says right now, right? Okay. Nobody meaningful that we're aware of has had their hair tonic deal blown up. And what the concern is that there's all sorts of agents and economists and attorneys that say, why the hell should I have to do this indexing and extra paperwork anyway? This is America. If I want to go pay somebody $1 million to promote my hair tonic, mm-hmm. who are you to tell me I can't do that? This wasn't collectively bargained. And there is a loom. There's this risk that this entire settlement structure about enforcing who gets paid and what is would run afoul of antitrust laws, mm. which then brings us to the Trump EO okay. and what the SEC and other major programs are trying to do in Congress to give the NCAA an exemption to enforce that.
Let me take a break right there because we'll turn a page and go to the Trump EO when we come back. Now that we've covered, if you're a university, you can pay whatever you want so long as you're under the salary cap of $20.1 million, is that it?
$20.5 million for the whole department this year.
Okay, so you distribute that money however you like. When it comes to name, image, and likeness, you got to run it through an accounting firm and have it audited to make sure that it's fair market value as it stands now. But that could be antitrust. What does the Trump EO have to say about that? We'll find out when we come back talking to our friend Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. If you have any questions or comments, and if you don't have any questions, you're not listening closely. 504-260-1870. It's the Oakmont Jeweler Talk and Text Line. Don't ever text and drive, but pass your questions along, and I will pass them along to Matt. When we come back, Tommy Tucker, WWL. And back to Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter, talking about NIL, the House settlement. What that said, I guess we can do a quick recap. The university's got a $20.5 million salary cap. They can spend it however they want. Name, image, and likeness has to go through, how you say that, accounting firm?
That would be Deloitte.
Deloitte.
They're calling it a clearinghouse.
A clearinghouse. So it's like an index almost where if it meets the fair market value, again, that's a very subjective thing, then it's allowed. Does that violate antitrust laws? I don't know. That maybe is what this all comes down to. Meanwhile, President Trump, a couple of weeks ago, issued an executive order about this. Tell me what that says as it relates to the House settlement and what I just said.
Yeah, so I've pulled this up here since we were talking. The order came out on July 24th. So, it was a couple of weeks ago. And the White House EO directs the Department of Labor, the DOE, the DOJ, to, quote, take appropriate measures to protect Olympic sports and non-revenue sports and to protect student athletes' rights and safeguard the long-term stability of college athletics from endless debilitating antitrust and other legal challenges. Now, the Trump administration cannot unilaterally grant the NCAA or the College Sports Commission, which is the fancy name for this clearinghouse, can't grant him an antitrust exemption all by himself. Congress needs to do that. The House has advancing legislation to do exactly that. It is very likely to pass. The Senate is less likely because you, in order to break a filibuster, you're going to need 7 Democrats to vote with it, potentially 8 if any Republicans decide to break off. And so the interesting question is whether the Trump administration kind of getting more involved in this makes it more or less likely that antitrust protection can get through the Senate. Because if you were a somewhat vulnerable purple state-ish Senate Democrat who might be persuaded to vote for this, are you now less likely to do it because now it's very clear that Trump wants it? I think that's unclear at the moment.
So, yeah, now you got politics, a lot of politics factoring into it, so not to mention with redistricting, who knows how that could play out. So,
sure.
When it comes to female sports, women's and Olympic sports, I don't know about the Olympic part, but the female sports seemingly would not be something that a conservative administration, generally speaking on this, would be in favor of. Did that kind of surprise you or not?
Let me ask one more question.
And how does that play into Title IX with any of this?
Sure. My terrible radio answer is that I think the policy and political questions here are really quite complicated. There have been many conservative lawmakers and politicians over the last 18 months that have gone out of their way to take up the vanguard of protecting women's sports. And generally, that's only in the context of trans athletes and sport participation. But if you want to be seen as credible on that issue long term, especially with the Olympics coming to the United States in the near future, there's going to be some lawmakers that are going to say, like, no, we want to continue to promote this Olympic pipeline. We want there to be college swimming and college tennis and college golf programs. And that ties into everything that we're talking about here, because as big universities, or actually as universities generally, are now sharing revenue directly with athletes and having to spend money to build an infrastructure to pay athletes, they also still, they're going to need money to still pay for all of these other Olympic sports programs. And with, you know, and with higher education facing significant budget cuts on a couple of other levels, it's not a surprise that many small programs throughout Division I over the last several months have already decided to drop programs. And so this is something that the White House, you know, based on the EO, has said that they're concerned about and wants to get ahead of. It's unclear to what extent the administration can force schools to continue to sponsor programs or push them to maybe add other ones. But we could say that about a lot of other things, and the White House has been able to extract concessions from elite colleges about other stuff. So that could very well be part of the push and pull over the next 6 months.
So bottom line, President Trump is trying to, you would fill in the blank with?
I would say bottom line is President Trump wants to be seen as the sports president. Okay. And he wants to be seen as the force that is going to get credit for saving college sports. And he wants to make sure that schools are not doing unpopular things like dropping women's tennis programs to pay for left tackles, and wants to use the executive office to pressure schools not to do that. How effective it is, what impact that will have on lawmakers or governors, still to be seen.
So
could work.
Rein in the lucrative name, image, and likeness deals known as NIL. I don't know what that means. I mean, the executive order is filled with a lot of nice words, but I don't understand quite what he's looking for. Am I missing something or not?
No, I don't think you're necessarily missing something. What I can tell you is that there is a pervasive thought among conservatives in the U.S. Senate and in the House that NIL has gone too far. Maybe many of your listeners might agree with that, right? There's too much money flying around. Athletes are transferring too often. That power has moved away from coaches and more towards agents or to players, and that is not right. And a world where, whether that's the NCAA, whether that's Deloitte, whether that's states, are able to impose more order and restrictions and something more closely resembling a collective bargaining agreement, that is an idea that has a lot of currency with lawmakers. Like, remember, one of the people that Trump listens to the most about this stuff is Tommy Tuberville, who hates where college sports is right now. And whether that lines up with the kind of free market ideal that may have been more popular among conservatives in like 1994, you know, that's a different conversation. But what I can tell you right now is that people that are close to the president and that the president listens to would like changes to this world. Whether you can do that via an EO or not, we don't really know.
So the Trump administration, through the Department of Education, it's no secret, is in the process of dismantling, as you said, the Title IX enforcement. But now they're saying to protect women's sports. So I'm thinking, well, maybe NIL is a way to protect women's sports if you could find people that are willing to pay for that. The other thing is, we'll pick it up when we come back, because I got to take a break here, Matt.
Yeah.
One thing I think that's getting lost in this, maybe perhaps especially when it comes to women's sports, perhaps not necessarily so, is a chance for people to receive college educations that otherwise would not, and how that affects the rest of their life, whether they're golfers, tennis, bowlers, whatever, that would otherwise not have had a college education. Not that college is for everybody, but you understand what I'm saying, right, in terms of opportunity?
I do. Let's talk about that after the break. I have a story coming out on this exact thing.
Outstanding. That, and we'll talk about the Olympic pipeline as well. Matt Brown, our guest, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. It is 9:35, time for traffic on WWL. All right, 9:41, 9:19 till 10. Quickly back to Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter, talking about the House settlement, about name, image, and likeness, about President Trump's executive order, about antitrust, Olympic pipelines, and more. Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, I think talking about the Olympic movement here is really important, because you alluded to this right before the break, and it's something that maybe not all of your listeners are aware of, but college sports is, I believe right now, the second largest college scholarship program in the country, just behind the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. And the gap isn't really isn't that large. It's how we not only train elite athletes in most Olympic sports, not just the United States, but really for athletes all over the world. But it is a major pipeline for people who might not otherwise be able to go to college or be able to afford college. One of the challenges with that movement right now is, as costs have increased throughout college sports due to revenue sharing, due to construction costs and labor for facility improvements are going up, the shortages for other athletic equipment, and also as higher education itself is in a really difficult position as enrollment has dropped, and certainly for many public schools here in Louisiana, as state funding has declined, as federal research grants have been cut all over the country. Schools are in a pinch where they're hurting financially generally, and now they might need to come up with an extra $5, $10, $15, $20 million in their athletic department, which is why many smaller schools have decided, all right, time to cut women's tennis, time to cut baseball, time to cut softball. And bigger schools have decided, well, maybe we'll keep the sport, but we'll cut the scholarships. We'll cut the coach. We'll cut the operations coordinator. We'll dial things back. That's something that the Trump administration is worried about. They signal that that's something, a trend that they want to stop in the EO, although it doesn't explain exactly why. And this is a conversation that's happening all over Washington right now about if we can't use this current system where LSU gymnastics and softball and women's soccer are paid essentially by excess profits from football, if we can't do that anymore, how are we going to pay for it? And the dirty little secret is, I'll tell you, Tommy, like everyone else in the world that's a rich industrialized country,
yep,
their national government is the primary source for funding for training elite athletes. And that's not something that we've done in this country. And we don't necessarily have to do it that way. But the ahead of the Olympics now, this is the time to talk about how do we intend to do this for the future?
Well, and it goes to, Matt, nothing is free, right? Nothing is free. And who pays in those other countries, those industrialized nations, to field these Olympic teams and to train these Olympic athletes?
It's for everybody else, it's usually the federal government. Mm-hmm. And it may surprise people that sometimes it's the federal government through the military. In some Nordic countries, in Germany, in some countries in South America, it's their military that helps pay for elite sport academies. In some countries, it's through a minister of sport. You know, it would be like a cabinet-level position like we have in the United States. We've decided to do it mostly through universities, some of which are funded in some roundabout way by the taxpayer, some not, and through private philanthropy. And that system right now is facing financial pressure that it hasn't faced in 100 years.
And the reason I say nothing's free is you can't clamor now for this, that, the other thing, but then when the Olympics rolls around, and I think the next one is the Winter Olympics of 2026, right, coming up next?
Yeah.
If the U.S. finishes last in this or last in that, and I don't know, Trinidad Tobago has more gold medals or more medals than we do, nothing against Trinidad Tobago, but I don't think their GDP is close to ours. Well, then you got to look back and see what's the reason for it. Let me address a couple of things here that have come in via text, and I didn't want to spend a lot of time going back because I like to stick with the newest developments with you. But somebody says the NIL, the end of amateur athletics, I thought once you're paid to play, you are professional. You've given us the background on this numerous times, but apparently whoever texted this in didn't hear, you know, like your story back to the 20s and the illusion, if you will, the delusion that college athletes were amateurs and not professionals.
Yeah, I don't mind going over this again. Yeah,
maybe not being paid would be a better way to put it than professionals, because I don't know if they made a living at it, but go ahead.
Sure. I think this is a fair question because it's something a lot of people struggle with. And what I would say to this individual is, throughout history, amateurism has been whatever we said that it was. In the 20s, 30s, 40s, and early 50s, a big question, particularly here in the Southeast, would be, hey, if you gave somebody an athletic scholarship, if you paid for their school, if you paid for their training table to play sports, aren't you compensating them? Then are you no longer an amateur? And people in Big Ten country and Big East country and the Pac-12, RIP, would say exactly that. And then we had a national conversation about it, and the folks in the South won, and then we decided, okay, that you're still an amateur. And then that expanded to laundry money, and that expanded to cost of attendance, and that expanded to other cash awards. And now we're at potentially making money from sponsors or from other third parties, and now for the first time, money directly from the school. What I would say is, more so than any other time in college sports history, I think it is impossible to argue with a straight face that Garrett Nussmeier, the quarterback at LSU, is an amateur. Like, no, he's literally from the university going to be making more money than either of us this year, probably more money than either of us will ever make. And good for him, because he's awesome. He's one of the best quarterbacks in the country at a school that's going to have an athletic budget of north of $200 million. He should be paid quite a bit of money.
Tim tells me that Garrett Nussmeier, not Garrett Nussmeier, right?
Please.
I get him confused. Garrett Nussmeier and Brian Kelly have the same agent. So that might be interesting when it comes to evaluating. I don't know. Go ahead. I didn't mean
to. Sure. This happens in pro sports all the time, too. It helps to have somebody with extra familiarity on both sides of the negotiating table when you're sitting down there. All of this is to say is, like, yeah, the amateur ideal, if it didn't die in 1904 when we first started cheating, it probably should be dead now, but legally speaking, these are not considered pro athletes the same way the folks in the NFL or NBA are.
Now, tell me what the Olympics say about professionalism, or have we done away with that completely, where that's not even – well, we've done away with it, I guess, because baseball players and everything else compete, right?
Yeah. We've had NBA players competing since, what, the 80s?
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, if you win a gold medal, the U.S. government cuts you a check. That I think is actually a good example of how the definition of amateurism has shifted. What made you an amateur in the Olympics? And
yeah. I didn't know this. If you win a gold medal, what happens?
Yeah, you get a check. It's not a very big check, but you get an award from the federal government. I want to say it's like five figures.
So the taxpayers award the gold. Well, if you want to say taxpayers, or they can print as much money as they want. Either way, it comes back to the taxpayers. Award gold medal athletes as it stands now, right?
That is my understanding. It's not an exorbitant amount of money. I don't know from what department it comes from, or whether it's from income tax or selling assets somewhere else, or part of some grants to sports federations or what. But yeah, you do get a little cash prize if you win a gold medal.
Well, it's it's all money. It's just one big bucket of money, no matter whatever feeds into it. Somebody texted in. I found this interesting. They said that.
Yeah.
NIL has shapeshifted from sponsorship and endorsements to a paycheck. It's trash. But is there really a difference between a paycheck and NIL?
Well, when you talk to some of the people that I've become professionally friendly with that were involved in the first NIL state laws in Florida and California and New Mexico, they'll tell you, we don't see a distinction between getting a check from McDonald's and Dr. Pepper or getting a check from Bubba Booster. Mm-hmm. We designed this to maximize economic liberty rather than just trying to maximize for just sponsorships. Certainly, the marketplace has changed, because it turns out there's not that many college athletes who are super marketable to McDonald's, who's responsible to shareholders and has a fiduciary responsibility to make money in a way that booster collectives are not. What I would tell anybody who might be frustrated about this, and when I write, I try to differentiate between booster-driven payments and brand-based NIL. But I actually deeply believe that commercial opportunities for athletes are a net positive. And one of the biggest reasons for that is that if you are an LSU athlete, whether you're playing women's soccer, football, basketball, rifle, whatever. I don't know if LSU has a rifle team, but like any sport, it's a major commitment. It's way more than 20 hours a week. And you can't have the same educational experience that maybe you or I did. You can't tell Brian Kelly, hey, coach, I love you, but I'm going to Italy for the semester. I'll see you in April. And through brand-based NIL opportunities, we are allowing athletes to have smaller internships and to be exposed to a broader array of professional contacts and opportunities that maybe you and I might have had. I think it's really important. Most LSU athletes, even four-star football players, are not going to be professional athletes 10 years after graduation. Yeah. And it's, I think, part of the point of American higher ed is to help prepare folks for what they're going to be doing in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. And if we do this right, NIL really can be a big part of that.
If we don't have a rival team at LSU with the Hunters we have here, we should. When it comes to high school and age of majority, does that factor into this at all? Because, you know, now high school athletes are being as heavily recruited from grammar schools. Yeah. And I just wonder, how far down does this filter? Is it about age of majority or enfranchisement? Can a parent make a deal for a kid? Is that slavery? I don't know. Talk to me.
No, these are really good questions. And the unfortunate answer is it matters. It depends so much by state.
Mm-hmm.
What ends up happening is that a teenager's high school athletic eligibility is governed by, like, their state high school athletic association. And based on whatever a state law says and whatever the high school athletic association says, you have a state NIL policy. Most states at this point will allow high school athletes to participate in brand endorsement deals. They have to follow whatever applicable child labor laws in the mm-hmm. state. If you're under 16, you have to have a parent or somebody else. But in most places, you're allowed to do this. Not everywhere. I believe Texas is one of the holdouts. There's a couple of other smaller states that say, like, if you sign one of these things before you turn 18, you lose your high school athletic eligibility. And there are players who may transfer out of state and go somewhere else as a high schooler to maximize their earning potential.
Is that much different than apprenticing your kid out as a printer in the Dickens age?
I think the money's a little bit better.
Money's better
than it was
right.
As a printer.
And maybe the work's more enjoyable. Thank you, Matt Brown. A pleasure as always, man. Publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. Give me the web address to subscribe.
Friends, you can find it at extrapointsmb.com, or you can find me on Twitter at Matt Brown EP.
Quick break. We'll find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.